It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on his teachings, giving meaning to the teachings of all the Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. The next three precepts received in the Bodhisattva initiation ceremony are called the three pure precepts. Embrace and sustain forms and ceremonies. Embrace and sustain all good. And embrace and sustain all beings. According to the Soto Zen tradition, the three pure precepts evolved from the teachings of all Buddhas, which is one of the best known and highly revered teachings among all schools of Buddhism. And it goes, refrain from all evil, practice all that is good, purify your mind. This is the teaching of all Buddhas. So that's been around from the beginning. The first recorded instance of this teaching of all Buddhas was from the Dhammapada, one of the earliest Theravadan texts written in Pali in the 5th century. The Dhammapada, it's a collection of gatha, which are little four-line verses, attributed to Shakyamuni Buddha himself. So this is a gatha, actually, what I just read to you. Refrain from all evil, practice all that is good, purify your mind. This is the teaching of all Buddhas. That's a gatha. And it's attributed to Shakyamuni Buddha. Embrace and sustain forms and ceremonies. The first pure precept basically refrain from all evil from the Dhammapada by wholeheartedly embracing and sustaining the forms and ceremonies of Zen practice. You abandon the self-centered way of living, which is the source of evil. So it's just a more positive reframe, basically. In practicing these forms, the self-centered concerns of the student will eventually show itself in some form of resistance. This is really, it's very interesting. You take on a form, well, let's say bowing, and in committing to practicing that form, resistance will show up, and in you're either overly submissive or too obedient, and so I hate bowing, or I get up in the morning and I bow 50 times before I go to the zendo, you know, and either way is I do this and I do that. It's precisely the opposite of the form of a bowing practice. So what I'm saying right now is that through these forms, you see your resistance to practicing them, and through the resistance, you see your self-centeredness, and that's where, when we say evil, it really means selfish, self-centered, I-based activities. I'm going to give you an example now of a form. It's a very precious one, and I hope that this will have meaning for you. When Dogen Zenji went to China and began to practice at the monastery where his brother monk was, or actually first teacher, I'll say, in 1223, he found that in the monks' hall, the monks rested their folded okesas, their robes on their heads, and chanted a verse right after early morning zazen every day. And the verse is, "Great robe of liberation, virtuous field far beyond form and emptiness, wearing the Tathagata's teaching, I vow to save all beings." And save, whenever you hear that word, save means saving from suffering. That's what save means. So wearing the Tathagata's teachings, I vow to save all beings. Dogen had read about this practice, but he had never seen it. And when he finally did see it, he wrote, "At that time, I felt I had never before seen such a gracious thing. I had never before seen such a gracious thing." Dogen wrote, "My body was filled with delight and tears of joy silently fell and moistened the lapel of my robe." Right then, he vowed to transmit this practice to Japan. And as a result, for the last 800 years, in Dogen Zenji's lineage, which I am, and as I'm passing on to you, we have chanted this verse every morning after zazen when we put on our okesas and raksus. So I am wearing today my raksu to give you a visual. It's patched. You can't really see it too closely, I don't think. Let me try if you can see this. But it's patched just like the okesa, sewn like the okesa. The okesa is the priest robes, with tiny straight stitches and a prayer for each stitch. And it's put atop your head and chanted on before morning, after morning zazen is over, but before removing it from its case and wearing it. So morning zazen, putting it on your head, chanting, removing it from its case. And lay people wear raksus and priests wear okesas. And you can see on the back, Suzuki Roshi's calligraphy. This is his calligraphy. Of the lineage of his sect from Shakyamuni Buddha through Bodhidharma, through Dogen. Bodhidharma brought the lineage to China from India, through Dogen, through himself, to me, Sanrei Esho, the name he gave me at the Bodhisattva initiation ceremony where I received the 16 great Bodhisattva precepts. The Buddha himself chose the kesa's design after the king, who was a disciple of the Buddha, embarrassed himself by getting off his cart to address a man that he thought was Shakyamuni's disciple. And it turned out he wasn't, and the king was embarrassed. And so he asked Shakyamuni to make a special robe for his disciples that could easily be recognized, so his disciples could easily be recognized as Buddhist monks. So with that in his mind, Shakyamuni's mind, one day he was walking with Ananda, his assistant, in the countryside, and he noticed the beautiful patterns of the rice fields, newly planted with green seedlings, and surrounded by footpaths. So there's all these squares. And he said, "These are so beautiful. Could you make a robe like this?" And Ananda agreed. And so the Buddha conceived the pattern and Ananda made the design. And since then, Buddhists of all traditions and in all countries have worn this robe. The kesa is the Buddha's body and the Buddha's mind. One of its names is a robe of liberation. To make them, Indian monks collected abandoned rags from graveyards and refuse heaps so that they could have no attachment to the material. So the liberation, the robe of liberation, the liberation is liberation from attachment, our greatest source of suffering, including attachment to our life. They cut the rags into pieces and washed and dyed them, and then sewed them together. But they didn't even in dyeing them, they didn't dye them pure colors like blue and yellow and red and white and black. They dyed them in mixed colors to darken the cloth and render it valueless by ordinary standards. The construction of the okesa or the raksu embodies egolessness, impermanence, and interdependent origination, the basic teachings of the Buddha, egolessness, impermanence, and interdependent origination. Those are the three big things. But if we grasp this as Buddhist teaching, as something important and to hold on to, we miss the point of Buddhist teaching. Instead, as one teacher puts it, we open our hands. So even Buddhist teachings, we don't grasp onto, and we don't criticize people who are not following these teachings. They're Buddhist teachings. We do our very best to follow them, and that's all. And it's the same with our lives. Our body and mind are collections of different elements that exist in this moment. Because they're always changing, we can't grasp them as my body, my mind, or my property. And yet we attach ourselves to them in their transient form. But since it's not substantial, we can't grasp it actually, and we can't control it. And when we try, we diminish our life force. So instead, we open our hands. And when we open our hands, we see that everything we need is an offering from the universe. Everything we need comes as an offering from the universe. And if we have something extra, we offer it to others. This is the life attitude of a bodhisattva. And the okesa or raksu is a symbol of this attitude. Letting go, opening our hands, is the same as Dogen's do, not understanding. So not understanding is an activity that we do. And we should do it a lot, according to Dogen, because all this thought is considered understanding. And by letting go, it's a kind of not doing. And in a fascicle of Dogen's entitled Not Doing Evils, he weaves together the relative, which is all the differences that make up our life, and the absolute, which is the oneness of all things. We've been talking about that sort of all the way through the Sandokai lectures. Dogen says that not doing is neither relative nor absolute, since not doing is non-dual. Non-duality is the meaning of pure in three pure precepts. The pure in three pure precepts means non-duality. And Dogen is teaching it as not doing. So when you think of Zazen, you get a visual of that, not doing. and non-duality. And this not doing, Dogen says, is our true nature. This not doing is actually Buddha nature. It means that we are not grasping things with our karmic consciousness or with the thoughts that arise from it. And in a minute, I'm going to be explaining karmic consciousness. Here's how Katagiri Roshi explains form. Because embrace all forms and ceremonies is the precept that we're on right now. And Katagiri Roshi explains form as our daily, this is, now I'm quoting from Katagiri Roshi, our daily life is just like casting pebbles into an ocean that is very serene. Every form, every action is just like this. The moment when the pebble becomes one with the ocean, you can immediately see the ripples. These ripples are called form. The form of washing your face, the form of having a meal. Ripples are the posture you sit with, like in Zazen. Ripples are when you talk, just talk. Ripples are the form of action. You were always living right in the middle of forms of action. You cannot get out of it. In the religious life, this is ritual, our everyday life. So living right in the middle of forms is our everyday life. When practiced properly, forms are actually the expressions of the interdependence of all things. Their true nature is that they have no fixed nature. For this reason, although we practice these forms with strength and meticulous attention to detail, we all the while apply to the forms gentleness and flexibility that arise from the awareness of their lack of inherent nature. So these forms lack inherent nature. This is different from what we often hear. So they have no fixed nature. We practice them with meticulous attention to detail, all the while aware of the lack of their inherent nature. Zazen is another one. Zazen's another form. And in the Zendo, we let go of everything. And this is also liberation, not only from our daily lives, but also from karmic consciousness created by all our twisted karma. In Zazen, we are determined not to take action based on thoughts coming and going. We all have thoughts. They come and go, and we do nothing. We just allow them to come and go. Therefore, we don't create new karma. This is what it means that in Zazen, we are liberated from our karma. Not moving means to be fully congruent with yourself. It means to be free of doing and not doing by fully settling into all aspects of your experience. It is simply selfless absorption of a sentient being in just being a sentient being. That's what Zazen is. Selfless absorption of a sentient being into just being a sentient being. And there's no karma here. There's no karma here. Only in Zazen can we stop making karma. When we leave the Zendo, we have to do something. To do something, we have to make choices. And the choices we make depend on our values, which are influenced by our karmic consciousness. I can't be free of karma, even when I try to do things simply for the sake of Dharma. That is still my choice, and whenever I make a choice, I am making new karma, whether good or bad karma, as a continuation of my past karma. I'm going to explain this a little more in detail. I'm going to try to go slowly. It's really important. This is a really important concept I'm about to explain to you. I have found it enormously helpful. Karmic consciousness refers to the storage of our past experiences. According to the Yogacara school of Buddhism, which is the mind-only school of Mahayana Buddhism, our consciousness can be categorized into 8 layers. The first 5 are created by our sense organs: eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body. So those are the first 5. The 6th layer of consciousness, vijnana, by the way, vijnana is the Sanskrit word for consciousness. So the 6th layer of consciousness is called mano vijnana, and it's our discriminating mind. It's like the function of our brain. That's the 6th layer, our brain. The 7th is called just manas, and it's translated as ego consciousness. So brain, first all those sense organs, then brain, ego, and this last one, the deepest layer, the 8th layer, is called alaya vijnana. Alaya means storehouse consciousness. Alaya vijnana. This is an extremely important part of you, a part of your layers of consciousness. All experience from birth and even before are stored in this deepest layer. This is all from Buddhist psychology. When we encounter a new object or situation, we interpret it according to what kind of seeds are stored in our storehouse. The way we view and react to things depends on the seeds we have. This karmic consciousness is how we are unique, because we all have different seeds. We've all had different past experiences, and they're stored in our alaya vijnana, our alaya consciousness. And so when we respond to something, we're coming from an entirely different place from any other unique sentient being. That's the teaching of Buddhist psychology. So in the Yogacara teaching, ego consciousness clings to the seeds stored in the storehouse consciousness as me. So the ego consciousness, that's the 7th one, clings to the seeds in the 8th one, the storehouse, as me. It makes the things in the storehouse consciousness me. And the ego consciousness controls the first 6. So the 7th consciousness as me controls the first 6. And that's how our way of thinking becomes self-centered and distorted. In the Yogacara understanding, when we attain Buddhahood, we are freed from this whole structure, and all of the layers turn into wisdom mind, all of the layers. So until then, we make a story of our lives, and the hero or heroine of the story is always me. And I watch myself do this constantly. I'm constantly making stories of my life, and the hero is always me, every single one. In Zazen, with our true Dharma eye, we see that distortion. We see how self-centered we are. And this can be very practical, because we can't really do anything about it until we see it. It's like in It's like the 12-step programs. Until you, you know, I'm an alcoholic, that's the first step to recovering from being an alcoholic. And it's the same with this. We need to see our self-centeredness, which is, according to the Yogacara teachings, all of the activity of that seventh level of consciousness. We need to see that before we can do anything about amending that situation. When we let go without grasping, without taking action based on thoughts, we're released from karmic consciousness. And this is the completely unique activity of Zazen. When we do Zazen, we are not creating karmic consciousness. Though the true nature of all things is formless and cannot be grasped, it can be realized through the forms of our everyday life. This precept, embracing forms and ceremonies, is an admonition to be impeccable in time and space, including being on time, eating what is offered, not wasting resources, using things appropriately and returning them to their proper places. Forms and ceremonies are not intended as programs to control ourselves. This is not about self-control. Rather, they provide support. They're freely given and offer a clear and gentle guidance and are meant to be embraced with non-attachment. Non-attachment. Because they are interdependent with circumstances in which they're practiced, they have no inherent nature. They dependently co-arise with every circumstance, and so everything is different in each circumstance. And so being upright and gentle is the appropriate attitude with which to practice these forms and ceremonies. We hold them as gentle guidance, like, oh, well, this is what the precept suggests that we do. And how would that look right now in this situation when my three-year-old is trying to raid the cookie jar? So the second pure precept, embrace and sustain all good, can be understood thusly. By faithfully practicing the first pure precept and embracing traditional forms and ceremonies, including the daily life ones that you have, we are freed from selfishness and self-centered action and may then enter the joy of liberation from attachment. Because don't forget, when you have a practice, anything you make into a practice, the practice does the practice. So you're out of it. So there's no, you're not making karma, really. The practice does the practice. And if you do this continuously, you are being practiced. And that's what you want. But you can't do that without the continuity. It's the continuousness factor, which is why Dogen, I think it was last week, and I read to you this long passage from Dogen that he kept, and the continuous of this and the continuousness of that and the continuousness of everything. And the reason he's so emphatic about that is that it's the continuity that makes for a platform of selflessness for the practice to do its practice. And we're just kind of around. And therefore, we're not creating karmic consciousness. We're not creating karma. Let's see. So the bliss that that graciously arises from renouncing selfish concerns is the source of embracing and sustaining all good. So it's basically leaving selfishness out of it, leaving self-clinging or self-centered ideas out of it. When we do that, that is called embracing and sustaining all good. Because remember in the beginning, it's the selfish and self-centered actions that are called all evil. So it just means self-centered in Buddhism. And evil means self-centered. I, me, things coming from the seventh level of consciousness. The sixth level of consciousness. I can't remember. The third pure precept, embrace and sustain all beings, follows from there. So Reb Anderson Roshi has a beautiful way of explaining this. I'm going to quote from him right now. After realizing selflessness by the practice of the first pure precept and being empowered with the immense joy and enthusiasm of the second pure precept, your body and mind are flexible and receptive, ready to be transformed into whatever is needed for the welfare of all beings. This transformation is the fulfillment of the Bodhisattva's third pure precept, embrace and sustain all beings. Absorption in the good of selfless liberation spontaneously overflows into nurturing all beings and helping them to mature. Empowered by the realization of the three pure precepts, you will gladly do whatever is beneficial, not only for humans, but for all living beings. I think what you can take from this is that these three pure precepts, they kind of all work together and piggyback on one another. And if you really understand the forms and ceremonies one, which are really just anything that you make into a practice in your everyday life. So that becomes a kind of ceremony, a little ritual. Then you are left out of it and the practice takes over. And this is what you want to do to follow these three pure precepts. Just to boil it all down to something simple. Suzuki Roshi says, what we are doing here is so important that we should not take it too seriously. We should never lose our sense of humor. I'm going to read that again. Suzuki Roshi says, what we are doing here is so important that we should not take it too seriously. We should never lose our sense of humor. So here are some of the important points from today's talk. These forms and ceremonies are not intended as programs to control ourselves. Rather, they provide support. That's so important. Think of the forms and ceremonies that you create in your everyday life as support, as suggestions for how to behave. Secondly, in the Yogacara teaching, ego consciousness clings to the seeds stored in the storehouse consciousness as me. And the ego consciousness, the seventh consciousness, controls the first six. That's how our way of thinking becomes self-centered and distorted. That's how we get there. In Yogacara understanding, when we attain Buddhahood, we are freed from this structure, and all the layers of our consciousness function as wisdom. Wisdom mind, that's the wisdom mind right there. Third, when we let go without grasping, without taking action based on our thoughts, we are released from karmic consciousness. And that's the practice part. When it's practice, it's all there. It just continues of itself. So we aren't taking action based on our thoughts, and we're released from karmic consciousness. This is the completely unique activity of Zazen. So that's one way to do that. Fourth, in practicing these forms, the selfish concerns of the student will eventually show themselves in some form of resistance. Once they are exposed by showing the resistance, we can work with them more effectively. And so in this way, the forms and rituals are a container that we require for understanding. So that's how they serve us. You know, we see, I don't want to do that. And that's resisting. And then we examine that and we learn about ourselves and we become better people. And finally, the fifth most important point from today's talk is what Suzuki Roshi says: what we are doing here is so important, we shouldn't take it too seriously. We should never lose our sense of humor. And some things for you to write about in your notebooks, which I hope you're doing, because writing is a way of integrating what you learn, and it helps you to focus your first, get in touch with your experience, and then writing it down integrates it and helps you remember what you're learning. And also, if you have all of this in a notebook, you can go back and go, now, what was that? I remember I was thinking about it in this way, and you actually wrote it down. So regarding what to write about in your notebooks, the first thing is to review in your mind today's talk and pick out some things that for you really rang true. Sometimes even small, seemingly completely unimportant details resonate strongly with your own experience. And as we now know, your own experience, we all have our own seeds in our storehouse consciousness. We're all completely unique. For me, that really helped me understand why every single person is so different. Anyway, take these things that resonated strongly with you personally and write those down. That's the first thing. First practice for your notebooks this week. And the second one is this Roksu is an example of emptiness or egolessness, impermanence, and interdependent origination. That's what it represents. Egolessness, impermanence, and interdependent origination. It embodies in itself the basic teachings of the Buddha. But if we grasp this as the Buddha's teachings and make it like something special and something to hold on to, we miss the point of the Buddha's teachings. So for your notebooks, try to explain in your own words how it could be that if we miss the point, if we try to hold on to these teachings, we're missing the point. How could that be? That's the subject for you to write on in your notebooks. How could it be if we miss the point of these teachings? How could it be that if we hold on to these teachings, we miss the point? How could that be? All right, and the third thing, Dogen says that not doing is neither relative nor absolute, since not doing is non-dual. This is the meaning of pure in the three pure precepts. This not doing is your true nature. It means that we are not grasping things with our karmic consciousness or with thoughts that arise from it. Again, try to explain in your own words how not doing is your true nature. How could this be? How could not doing be your true nature? And don't forget that not doing is Zazen itself. So you can remember that as you're writing. Fourthly, when we encounter a new object or situation, we interpret it according to what kind of seeds are stored in our consciousness. The way we view and react to things depends on the seeds we have. This karmic consciousness is how we are unique. Can you tell a story of your life that demonstrates how your unique seeds, stored in the deepest layer of your consciousness, have steered the way to your decisions? What's an example from your own life, your daily life, of how your unique seeds in your eighth level, your storehouse Alaya consciousness, how have they made decisions for you? How has that enacted itself in you? And lastly, fifthly, for your notebooks, even though you don't think of them as forms and ceremonies, name some daily activities that through regular repetition have become a form or ceremony for you. What are some of the things you do that have turned even maybe without volition into a practice for you, so that they're a form or ceremony for you, like a little ritual for you? Even washing the dishes. I wonder if there are questions.
Gail, the first question we have is, hello, Gail. Thank you very much for your time and for sharing this with us. Your comment in last week's question and answer prompted this question. I struggle a lot with depression, which sometimes feels real and sometimes just feels like a habit. What would be your suggestion for laying a new neural pathway that moves away from that habit? Also, please, could you speak to ways to do this which are accepting and gentle rather than suppressing or rejecting?
The shortest answer I can give is probably the same thing I said last time, which is to create a new neural pathway that you lay down over the old neural pathway. And the best way to do that is to make up a sentence for yourself. Make up a one sentence opposite whatever is the old neural pathway, whatever the description of that is. Have a one sentence description of the very opposite. And so every time the old habit like in this case, depression, every time the thoughts of depression or the thoughts of whatever you think is your habit, you say, you have a sentence, you say, no, from now on, I'm going to be joyful and focusing my life on the welfare of others. I'm just making that up. So you say a sentence that you've made up, this is in your control, you've made up this sentence that is exactly the opposite. And as soon as the first sign of the old habit comes, you interrupt it. You actually, let's say it's me, Gail, stop it. Gail, stop. Stop that. Da-da, your new sentence. And so it's like, stop that. And then you say your new sentence. And you do that every single day for 3 months, really. And you will find that you've laid down a new neural pathway. And your old neural pathway gets sunk lower and lower and lower. So it has less power over you. That was something that I said last week in the questions and answers. I hope that answers your question. I've experimented with this myself personally in what I thought was a life and death situation. And so I was very emphatic about doing it every single day. And I did it. I noticed that the first flicker of change was like the last day of the third month. So you have to be diligent. That's all.
Thank you, Gail. The next question is, thank you very much for the talk. I'm struggling to believe that I'm not creating karma while I practice, like it or not. For example, maybe my mind wanders down familiar negative patterns. Then I notice that, get cross with myself, then remember not to judge, and then come back to the breath. How do I have not generated karma in that moment?
Yes, you haven't generated karma because the practice is doing the practice, not you. This is not about you. This is not your ego consciousness. I mean, isn't that amazing and wonderful that there's something we can actually do to get out of our ego consciousness? And that's create the practice. So if you're talking about Zazen, Zazen does Zazen, and you're like a bystander. And so all these racing thoughts, they have nothing to do with Zazen doing Zazen. Zazen is doing just as thorough a job of Zazen as if you didn't have racing thoughts. So don't worry about it. That's all. That's the best I can say. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. If it's a practice, which takes continuous effort, if it's a practice, then you're good to go. That's my answer.
The next question is, now what is pure again? I keep forgetting.
It's understandable that you forget because pure is non-duality. Pure is non-duality. And it's something that we aren't conscious of experiencing. It's like your eye doesn't see itself seeing. Your eye doesn't see itself seeing. So because it's so in the experience of seeing, it can't see itself seeing. And that's how non-duality is. We're inside non-duality, and so we can't see it. Therefore, it's easy to forget. And that's when we say three pure precepts, the pure means three non-dual precepts, three precepts that are all part of this dependent co-arising. They're all part of impermanence and they're all part of egolessness. Those three things, dependent co-arising, impermanence, and egolessness. Those are the three main Buddhist teachings. And that creates a situation where that's non-dual. And that's what we call pure. Maybe the purity, if a good way to remember that is if it's non-dual, again, it's not leaving leftovers. For me, that image of leaving tracks is very powerful. So I can think of it that way. Or now we can think of it as not leaving defilements in our Alaya storehouse. You can think of it however you want, though. I'm just talking. That's all.
So the next question is, I hate rituals. It's almost like a deal breaker. Are they really essential for practicing Zen? Why can't I just sit?
Rituals are important. We have to come back to emptiness. And the way we do that is through form and through forms of action. So we've already cast a pebble into the ocean, and that's the starting point of our presence. And we can't perceive this action because it's the activity of the oneness of the universe. It's a similar answer to the previous question, but we can understand the ripple, which is our daily life, the forms of our actions. Reb Anderson Roshi says, the Buddha way is all pervading and free of limits, yet without some container in which to practice, it cannot be fully realized. I'm going to say that again. The Buddha way is all pervading and free of limits, yet without some container, which is a form or a ritual or a practice, in which to practice, it cannot be fully realized. We have to have forms, and rituals are forms in action. But the good news is a lot of the rituals you can make up yourself and let them serve you. You know, I brush my teeth every morning. That's a ritual. I pet my dog every afternoon when I come home. That's a ritual. Okay, that's all.
So somebody asked, can you say more about the practice of a form?
I think the thing that people have the most trouble with about practice is when they get bored, they can't sustain the, it's like they lose interest. This is not entertaining. But it's the continuity again, it's the continuity that is the critical piece, continuous. It needs to be continuous. And so if you get bored or lose interest, do it anyway and just watch your mind. Watch your mind, because when you have a practice, the practice serves as a mirror to your mind, and you get to see your, oh, look at that. That's my bored mind. What does that look like? Or that's my mind that, you know, hates doing this. What does that look like? And I wonder why I hate it so much. It's not really that bad. Why do I hate it so much? What's going on? That kind of thing. That's what a practice will elicit from you if you stay with it and work with it. And working with it works out the kinks. It works out the kinks of your ego. And the end result is the practice does the practice. And it becomes easier for you because the practice has taken over. That's all.
So the next question is, Please, could you remind us how to make our own practice? How do I make petting my dog when I come home a practice?
By telling yourself. So you name it, you name it. And doing it. So when I come home, my dog dashes up to me and I hug it and I give it a snack and we have a little time together. And I take on as a practice that loving of my dog. That loving of my dog becomes a daily event that I make sure happens no matter what. And then the practice takes over having it happen. The practice of loving your dog, it's like loving your dog loves your dog. I hope that was clear. You name it, and then you allow it to do it. So loving my dog loves my dog. Feeling gratitude for everything that comes to me in my life from the universe. Gratitude practices gratitude. That's how you make each thing that you want to make into a practice. In a way, you name it and you allow it to make itself. You allow it to do itself. So it's more hands off. And then I am not doing it. There's no I involved anymore. That's the critical piece, is that I lets go.
So we have like a follow-up question to this. I think you have spoken about it a lot, but I'll share the question and you can answer. How do you keep continuous practice alive? I get bored. I have good intentions going in. And in a few weeks or months, it dies. There's nothing left.
I think we talked about this a few weeks ago, boredom. Boredom has to do with self-clinging. And so if you just know that, then be curious about your boredom. When it sets in, instead of reacting to it, be curious and maybe talk to it. Talk to your boredom and see where it's coming from and see. It's not your real self. And so see what's up. You know, what is this part of me that becomes an obstacle to what I've set out to do? I've set out to do Buddhist practice and to make my daily life into different practices. Why are you boredom getting in the way? Why are you wanting to be an obstacle? And then you work with your obstacles by naming them as obstacles. And so that makes it all clear what you're doing. I see that I'm out of time, and so I can't say anything more about that. But that really is enough. You should be able to, I hope that you're able to use that for your question. And if you can't, please ask it again. Thank you so much. And next week, we'll start the 10 grave precepts, which is what most of us have been thinking of as precepts. We'll start that next week. Bye-bye.